It's Wednesday. Wednesday, November 3rd, 2010. Ethics. So we have our test opening after class today, and we're going to talk about Peter Singer and his discussion on world poverty, and also talk about the objection to utilitarianism, that it's too demanding. After that, we'll do some small group work, and then review for the exam. So the objections we've discussed so far of utilitarianism, one is that it's too permissive. That utilitarianism not only allows you, but says it's your moral obligation to kill, to torture, to do all sorts of things that most people think are wrong, whatever the consequences. And you're required to do those things if, by doing them, you can create the greatest happiness. And so you can think of a circumstance where, say, the example we talked about last time, where you have an organ donor case, and you have the unwilling organ donor. So the unwilling organ donor goes in for a tonsillectomy. You have five people needing transplants, five people who are very important to society, one person who's, you know, maybe got some potential, but maybe not. And you go on the odds, right? So now, could this person turn out to be the person who discovers a cure for cancer? Well, maybe. But what if you have a research scientist who's on the verge of discovering a cure for cancer, who's going to die if he doesn't get a new liver? Well, then it seems like you go with the probabilities. And some people say, well, you never know when you're trying to figure out the greatest happiness. You never know what could happen. As if, like, should I walk out of my house today? I might get struck by lightning. And that might happen, right? It might be that if I walk out of my house and it's a cloudy day and there's thunder, I could get struck by lightning. But what are the odds? Okay, now, if I, like, drink to excess and get in my car and weave down the road where I can, like, barely see, then there's a chance I can get into an accident and maybe hurt myself and hurt some innocent people. What are the odds? Well, pretty damn good that I'm going to hurt myself or some other people or get arrested or go to prison. So that has negative utility, right? So there's a big difference between walking outside of my house during a rainstorm and driving home drunk. That's why we would say that drunk driving is bad and wrong. Walking outside your house is something you normally do, and just not think about it, because the odds of being struck by lightning are so low. And by the way, your chances of dying a terrorist attack are actually much smaller than being struck by lightning, or much larger than being struck by lightning. So if you're worried about the terrorists getting you, you know, relax and worry more about, like, driving home at 2 a.m. even when you're sober, because there's all those drunks out there that might plow into you. Although, I guess with the latest ballot measures, they're going to be looking at mandatory prison sentences after repeat offenses. So it's all in utilitarianism. It's all about playing the odds and trying to figure out what's going to produce the most happiness. And in that way, utilitarianism is the most empirical of the moral theories, because you really got to use your head and figure out what causes what. What means will lead to what ends, and the means are totally irrelevant. So, and you should see, like, killing an innocent person is a means to an end. So sure, you've killed one, but then there's five other people who are going to live, so you're up four, right? And so if all those people were exactly the same and had the same worth, then you'd still be up four. If the five people you're saving are really produce a lot of happiness, and the one person you kill doesn't produce that much happiness, or maybe he's just like a person that nobody likes. Maybe he goes around creating negative utility. Maybe he's kind of a miscreant and a troublemaker. Maybe you use, like, a prison inmate or something. Somebody who's gone out and has, like, a record a mile long, and he goes around committing petty crimes and taking people's property and vandalizing things and getting into fights and causing public disturbances. You know, you might even come out ahead of utility getting into that guy, right? And it might be that he's a young, you know, hooligan, and so he's got some really good organs. And so maybe that he's the ideal candidate for an unwilling organ transplant. So the most important thing, you might say, is not to get caught, right? So, because if you get caught, you have all these negative side effects. Now, again, you can play the other side and say, okay, well, maybe utilitarianism wouldn't tell you to do that, because even if the chance of getting caught is oh so small, if that happens, the consequences are oh so big. So you have to consider that what are the chances of X happening? And then if X actually does happen, how bad would consequences be? So this is why, like, you have auto insurance, for example, other than the fact that it's mandated by state law. But even if it wasn't mandated by state law, I would have automobile insurance. Why? Because even though the chances of getting an accident are relatively small, when an accident occurs, you could be liable for tens of thousands of dollars, even hundreds of thousands of dollars if you hurt somebody in an accident and it's your fault. That could be really bad. So that's why you have the insurance to pay for something you couldn't normally afford. And that's why it's a good idea to have catastrophic health insurance, just to pay for, like, if you get cancer or something like that. So again, utilitarianism, you have to kind of play the odds. And so, but it looks like sometimes it appears that if the chances of getting caught are small enough and the payoff for killing someone is big enough, that's what you should do. And you're killing in the name of the greater good. An easier case might be the terrorist. You got a terrorist who knows a nuclear bomb's going off, and you're Jack Bauer, and you're going to make the guy talk, right? Now, it might be that the guy's innocent and you made a mistake. Well, so you try to figure out, is this guy really guilty? And maybe what you should do is, like, what if the guy is like a hardened criminal who won't talk? This was like in a previous episode of 24, you had this terrorist who was, you know, they just beat the hell out of him, and they're like, you know, big electric prods, and they're punching him, and he's all like bloody, and he's got a black eye, and he's kind of bruised. And he's like, you know, I'm not going to talk. Yeah, the bomb's going to go off, and you're all going to die. Wah! Right? He's a bad guy anyway, right? And so then he says, okay, well, maybe you don't care about yourself, but I bet you care about a son. Here's your son on closed circuit TV. And there's, like, you know, some guy, like CIA guy in the hood, and he's got the gun pointed to his son's face, and he says, okay, tell me where the bomb is, or your son gets it. So now you're not even getting, like, the baddie, the terrorist, but you're taking care of his son. And so he actually, you see in the monitor that the son is shot. And then the guy's like, oh, you killed my son, right? And he's like, okay, but you still got one son left. Here's your other son, the one that you like even more. What do you think about him? And, you know, tell me where it is. And the pressure's on. And finally the guy breaks and gives up the information. And it worked. And because it worked, and it led to the bomb, you know, not going off and tens of thousands of people not dying horribly, that was the right thing to do, according to utilitarianism, it seems. And now some people would say it's always wrong to torture, whatever the consequences. Even if it's a bad guy, even if he deserves it, it's always wrong to torture someone. And there's negative side effects that might encourage other torture to go on when it's not necessary. But you can see making the case where, well, what, you're going to let 10 million people die in the nuclear explosion? And it turns out that he didn't really kill the guy's kid. It was all theater. They made it look like the kid killed the guy's kid, but he really didn't. And you're like, oh, I guess Jack isn't that bad a guy. He's just, you know, he's not going to kill innocent people. But then you think about when the consequences are really, really bad. What are you going to do? Are you going to hold on to your moral scruples and say, oh no, torture is wrong, and watch the 10 million people die horribly? Or are you going to do what needs to be done? And I think the utilitarian says that those who hold on to this sort of rigid principle are like the idiots who, like, they've got someone in their car who's dying and the speed limit says 65. They're like, well, the law is the law. I'm going to drive 65 miles an hour even though my friend's life is ebbing away and every moment counts. And I'm going to come to a complete stop at every stoplight even though it's 2 o'clock in the morning and there's no traffic on the road. That's foolish. So rules are meant as a guideline. Most of the time it makes sense to follow the rules of ordinary morality. But there are always cases where you're called to break the rules of thumb that most of us follow for the greater good. So that's the two permissive. So the other side of that is that the utilitarians say the ends justify the means. And they think that you can do all sorts of things to individuals and treat them in horrible ways for the greater good. And that there's something wrong with a moral theory that says that under certain conditions, you might even be obligated to torture a little baby if the conditions were right, for the greater good. To murder people, to people justify, like, on utilitarian grounds, dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So during World War II, we had this bloody invasion of Okinawa. Deaths not just on the American side, but also on the Japanese side. Fierce fighting, hand-to-hand fighting, bayonets, just, you know, massive slaughter. And so, after the fact, people said, well, look, you could either have had a bloody land invasion, you could have given peace on Japan's terms, which might have been meant in the long term that Japan's, what happens in Japan is what happens in Germany after World War I, where you have a defeated foe, but bad, people weren't careful about how they, settled the war, and pretty soon Germany is this military expansionist country and starts another world war. So the argument was, well, okay, we'll have to drop a bomb on Japan to give them the Nephilimeter, and what are we going to do? You're going to kill 200,000, 300,000, 500,000 civilians by dropping this weapon of mass destruction on these cities to get Japan to surrender. And after the second bomb, Japan surrendered. Now, historically, I would say it's marginal that we really need to drop those bombs. Japan was ready to surrender, and the final terms of peace were actually pretty close to what had been talked about before we dropped the bombs. But imagine that Japan isn't going to give up unless you do something like that, and that's the only way to do it. Well, you might say, okay, well, are you going to see, like, say, a million deaths in a bloody invasion and occupation? Or are you going to go for 500,000 civilian deaths by dropping an atomic bomb, or maybe keep it to 200,000? You could almost see dropping the first one, but the second one seems just like overkill. And actually, but then another thing that people forget is that before that, we firebombed Tokyo, and we killed about as many people in Tokyo as we did with dropping the atomic bomb. So, but you can see that reasoning, right? We're going to kill 200,000 people. Why? So a million people don't die. It's the same thing on a grander scale as killing one to save five. So on that case, people get a little more, squeamish. But when it deals with, like, killing one bad person to save 10,000, then people say, well, I'll go for that. Did you have your hand up, or you just...
Oh, I mean, like, but the thing is, where do you stop? Where is it goes from okay to not okay? Okay, so 10,000 is okay, but
yeah.
5,000.
Yeah.
It's like, how far, you can squeeze the thing, where is the next border at?
Uh-huh.
And on Japan is, for example, if you kill like a million people versus 200,000, which that is the fire was. Million, but it's very subjective because it's a million soldiers.
People
who sign the dotted line knows the risk, accepts the risk, versus civilians who are completely separate from that. So how do you go soldier's life versus civilian life in that conflict?
Although you also had, like massive suicides, like in Okinawa, like women were like killing their children and jumping off cliffs and just doing horrible things because they were told when the Americans could come, they're going to come a raping and a torturing. So, you want to die honorably. So, I mean, you get civilian deaths related to that. But people typically will make a distinction between combatants and non-combatants. That's deontological thinking. That's thinking in terms of rights and responsibilities and what people agree to and what people would ordinarily expect. Whereas the utilitarians are just looking at numbers. They're looking at happiness. They're looking at you can see like Bin Laden, attacking the World Trade Center. 3,000 deaths, but it, to him, this is an economic target. It's New York City. It's Wall Street. It's the trade towers are the symbol of American imperialism. And to him, you're killing some innocent people, but this is an all-out war. And so in his mind, there's no distinction between killing a bunch of American collaborators who are part of the imperialist economic machine that's oppressing the world and killing American soldiers. He would say, I think, from a utilitarian calculus, pragmatically, when you can get your guys on board a plane and steer them into buildings, you're not going to go out against like American gunships, the attack helicopters out there with your AK-47 when there's five Apaches there with 50 caliber guns and heat-seeking missiles, and you know they're going to blow you out of the sand. They're going to destroy you. That's not that. That might be a fair fight, but that's sort of like this is like in ancient, not ancient warfare, but actually in ancient warfare. But also going back to the Revolutionary War, you'd have soldiers, and you know they'd be, you know, marching with brightly colored uniforms in formation, you know, being hit by musket ball, and they just fall over, you know, and they even like have some guy who's like playing the drums and somebody else with a flute, right? They'll just march into enemy fire. It's where the Americans are like, you know, hiding in the trees with their squirrel rifles, picking off the redcoats. And that's one of the reasons why the Americans won the Revolutionary War, and also why, you know, setting roadside bombs in Iraq and, you know, ambushes and all that stuff is really effective against the American might. So I think that insurgents in Iraq and Al-Qaeda, they see terrorism as sort of just good tactics. And if you're looking at not, again, the means, but the end, which is victory, the means becomes irrelevant and it becomes by any means necessary. Yeah?
Terrorism is perspective, because you could say that the Americans in the Revolutionary War used terrorist tactics against redcoats. So it's all about perspective. If you're on this side, yeah, they're terrorists. On their side, they're freedom fighters.
Yeah, you saw like in Germany, you had like the insurgents in Germany that opposed Hitler that were trying to blow up trains and like, I mean, they're going after military targets, not civilians. But they're going around trying to blow up infrastructure and cause trouble for the German regime there too. So. Sure. So the question is, what, you know, is there a case where terrorism is somehow illegitimate on, you know, utilitarian grounds? And it seems that for the utilitarians, if the end justifies the means, then if your end is good, your means are morally justified. The problem is, you know, if your end is everyone under a religious theocracy, or if your end is the master race ruling the planet, or whatever, those seem like they're bad ends, and so the means turn out not to be morally justified. Evan?
I was just going to bring up another example of terrorism. Typically, like, if you've seen V for Vendetta, like, people typically watch that movie and they side with the terrorist, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, because he's terrorizing the religious theocracy,
Yeah, so it's fighting against a totalitarian regime. You might think, well, that's, you know, that's a revolution. It's not terrorism, although his tactics are... Although I don't think he doesn't necessarily... He doesn't really go against civilian. He's mostly fighting against the police,
right,
and the army, which I think in the movie are the same thing. So let's talk a little bit. So that's the two permissive. So we can go back and forth on that. And there's actually some hard case scenarios we can look at a little bit in our small groups. The other objection is that it's too demanding. And so this is the objection from Peter Singer, who's a philosopher at Princeton, and one of the top philosophers, and actually a very very well-known and respected philosopher. I think a great, to my mind, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. And so let me... get this up here. There we go. So he's got his solution to world poverty. So what is Peter Singer's solution to world poverty?
Everybody donates, excess the money they earn or use instead of spending their
Sorry, a little bit louder, please. A bit picked up here.
Spending their money on luxuries, they buy only the necessities and donate the rest to help others.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
One of the things that I noticed as far as the problem with that, because when they were saying, you know, if you made $50,000 a year, you only need 30 to survive, then you should donate 20. If you make $100,000, you still only need 30,000 to survive, so you can donate 70. It just doesn't seem to make much sense, because he's saying that $30,000 a year is what everybody needs to survive. Well, I mean, I've actually seen people who can make ends meet on like $300 a month. So, I mean, they're surviving on like less than $10,000 a year. you know. But then on the same time, I know people that they make $150,000 a year, but because of the lifestyle that they've chosen for themselves, even if they wanted to, they couldn't because their eyeballs deep in debt, trying to pay off their RV and pay off their, you know, their hot tub and their trip to Jamaica and stuff like that. So they played, and now they're paying for it. What are those people supposed to do?
He also says, though, that only the people who can actually afford to do it, but as they ever do. So obviously, if you're knee-deep in debt, you can't afford to donate that much money.
Well, and that would be one of the things to consider is, you know, the average American is $25,000 in debt.
Well, Singer's kind of a pragmatist, though. I mean, you can pay that off in payments, right? If you're, the thing is, like, the average American might, you know, might be making, I don't know what the salary amount is, but I mean, you pay off a little bit, or you bankruptcy, or what have you. And some of that is just on paper, like your house is devalued, and maybe it's going to come up in 10 years, maybe. So, but that, I think what Singer says is that most people don't give as much as they should, and not anywhere near as much as they should, and that most people can afford to give a great deal, and that he suggests, you know, you could start out a certain amount, and I suppose what you'd say about Singer is he makes some concessions to reality, although most people see his view as totally unrealistic. He says, look, you know, you don't have to, like, live off of, like, a bowl of rice and vegetables every day and live in, like, a yurt, like, on the edge of town, and, you know, and ride your bicycle, rain or shine, into town at your job and work, like, 60 hours a week at a job you hate to make a bunch of money to give it away. So he recognizes psychologically, people need a little, some creature comforts. But he says most people, they blow their money on trivial pleasures while people are starving and dying of preventable diseases in the third world. And he says if you think about that deeply enough, you'll see that that is not a morally acceptable way to live, and that you should do more, and you should do as much as you can. And so one reaction to that is that that's sort of too much to ask of people, that it's not only not realistic, but it's not really my fault that there's people dying in the third world. And so why should I be responsible for them, is the sort of counter-argument. On the one hand, you might make the following argument. Okay, I'm a utilitarian. What am I going to do today? Well, it seems that I know what makes me happy, and I know to a lesser extent what makes my friends happy. My wife and I, you know, Halloween's just over, right? Thanksgiving's around the corner. What does that mean? Christmas season, right? So my wife and I play this game. Guess what you got me for Christmas, honey? And what that means is we each buy ourselves gifts because we know what we like more than the other person does. And we allow a little more, we buy a little more for Christmas. Everything's discounted, right? It's the everyone's buying, so everyone's lowering their prices to get you know, the people to buy from them in a competitive market system. Most consumer spending happens between November and December 25th in the United States. So, but the reason why we don't get each other gifts is that we think we can maximize utility by buying ourselves gifts because we know what we like. Now, sometimes I'll give my wife things as a surprise. I don't call her up and say, hey, honey, do you want this? I take a chance that she would like, you know, something like some little treat that they're selling downstairs that I know she's liked in the past, or I'll bring her home some little knickknack or something, or I see something in a shop window, I'm like, oh, she would love this, and because I know her taste, I know that she loves, you know, Glee and American Idol, right? So if I see something that's related to them, like, I'd show her that, and there's a chance she'll want to see it. So like, if I know her taste, even though that's not what I like, now, if she were to get me, like, some merchandise having to do with Glee or American Idol, I wouldn't be pleased, because it's not something I'm interested in. So we have different tastes, and then the same thing with our extended friends and family. And so also there's a proximity, right? I'm living with this woman. I see her every day. And so it's a lot easier, it seems, for me to do things and make her happy than to try to find some random stranger to make happy. And so some people try to make this argument that maybe utilitarianism isn't that demanding. It just says to be, you know, look to the interests of the people around you. Look to the interests of first your family, then your community, and then maybe the nation, and then maybe last the world. And there's this idea that you focus your energy on local things and your immediate family and friends, and then sort of your resources diminish as they go outward. If the world were homogeneous and everyone had a bourgeois middle-class lifestyle, that might be the case. But when you have some people living in relative luxury and other people starving to death and dying of preventable diseases, Peter Singer says that's not really going to work. Because think about it. Suppose you got a couple of kids, you're taking them out for ice cream, right? And, you know, and Susie's got a little chocolate ice cream cone, and you're giving a strawberry one to Johnny, and then you, like, look down on the ground, and there's, like, a kid laying in the ground there, and flies are buzzing around his head, and his ribs are sticking out, and he's reaching his hand out, saying, "Help me," right? And then you, like, look over to your right, and there's, like, there's a vulture perched on a fire hydrant, licking his chops, looking at the kid, and thinking, "Oh yeah, it's gonna be a good meal in a few minutes here." Do you continue to like get ice cream with your kids and take them off to the zoo or the park to play? No, you'd help this kid, right? Because he's right there in front of you. Now, Singer makes the point. What difference is there between doing that and like blowing $20 on dinner and a movie, and when you could have sent that money to Burundi or some hovel in South America or Southeast Asia where people barely have, or Africa where people have barely enough to survive, Zimbabwe, or there's some of these West African countries in particular are just living in dire poverty. People are displaced by civil war, famines because of drought, just all sorts of problems. And there's people who are literally not getting enough calories to develop properly, for their brains to develop, and to stave off diseases. And child mortality in the third rate world is very high. And sometimes it could be something as simple as a few dollars from some mosquito netting to keep the kids from getting malaria. You put it over their beds at night so they don't get bitten by mosquitoes and catch malaria or West Nile virus or something. Or it's the kids die of dysentery. How would you like to be a kid 4 years old and die of diarrhea, essentially? It'd be a horrible way to die. And there's a really simple, you get some simple antibiotics that just cost, less than a dollar, and a gruel made of sort of like oatmeal type gruel with a bunch of sugar in it for calories, and that's just really, really bare bones simple things that you take for granted. Clean drinking water. We take for granted. I mean, people around here, they can drink water out of the drinking fountains, and it's got a little chlorine in it. It's not that good for you, but I mean, the water is fine, it's safe, and people who are living in poverty buy water in a bottle. And then throw the bottles in the trash or recycle them. They're made out of oil anyway. It's totally wasteful. And most of the water that you get, the bottled water you buy, comes from the municipal water supply anyway. They just run it through a bare bones filter and then sell it to you for more than gasoline. Some things I just don't understand, but that's a completely other tangent. Think about this. What if you took the money you're wasting buying on water and just sent it someplace? Sent it to Save the Children or UNICEF or Oxfam is Peter Singer's favorite one. That's money that's not doing you any good. It's just money down the drain. The utility for that is completely marginal. If you really care about water quality, get like a cheapo $20 water filter and stick it on your faucet and fill up your water bottle in the morning and reuse it, and that would give you the same thing. Or just drink out of the fountain. And that's wasted money that you could spend on saving, and I mean literally saving a child's life. Peter Singer says it is demanding, but that doesn't really show that something wrong with utilitarianism. It means there's something wrong with you. If you say, "Oh, that's too much sacrifice. I don't want to sacrifice. I'd rather go out and blow my money on the music and getting drunk and doing drugs and fancy designer clothes and eating out every night. And just think about, now I know a lot of you poor students, you know, you're just getting by, but I'm always amazed at how much money students seem to have for fancy cell phones and a regular cell phone bill. Techno gizmos, music, concerts, which, you know, aren't cheap these days. You know, there's most students even have a lot of disposable income, although you may be the exception. But Singer says everybody has something to give. I know there are individual people here that live in dire circumstances. I even have, you know, homeless students in my classes. So, I mean, and students living in halfway houses. So, I mean, I understand that some people have it really rough, and you can't tell just by looking at someone whether they're homeless or whether they're about to be kicked out of their apartment or what have you. But, you know, most college students spend a lot of money. I mean, they're targeted by advertisers for a reason. Even community college students have a fair amount of disposable income. And even if it's $20 or $30 a month, Singer says it can be something. And then he like hard sells you and keeps on giving you the 800 number to call and tells you to call now. So a couple of examples here, Bob's Bugatti. So Bob has this Bugatti, which is a fancy Italian sports car. And it costs, I think, $200,000, something like that. So he's got, and he's foolishly parked on the railroad tracks. Here comes the train. And then he sees there's a kid on the railroad tracks down the way. No way to get in touch with the kid, tell him to move off the tracks. And so he's got a choice about where he wants the train to go. If he does nothing, the train's going to plow into his Bugatti. Right? So, but he's next to a switch, and what he can do is he can pull that switch, and so the train will not hit his Bugatti, but instead it will be diverted and hit the kid. Or he could work it the other way, right? You could say, well, he could do something in that he could, let's see, make sure, what did I say? If he pulls the switch, it doesn't hit his car, but it hits the kid. You could say that the train's going to hit the kid, and if he pulls the lever, it's going to hit his car. I think that's the way Singer has it. So imagine the train's going to hit the kid. He's going to die, but you can pull the lever. If you pull the lever, the train's not going to kill the kid, but it's going to run into your beloved sports car, which also represents all of your life savings. So imagine that Bob pulls this, that Bob, you know, either pulls or doesn't pull the lever, and it leads to it leads to the kid being hit instead of his car. What would you think about Bob? He did what he had to do. He did what anybody would do. Or what a horrible human being. I mean, you think like a horrible human being, right? But then what he says is that that's like what most people do every day when they, you know, they save for retirement and they put staff money in the bank while there's people dying, you know, in third world countries that they're not helping. Every time you go out to movies or spend money on something you really don't need, some new tech gizmo or you get people that pay $4 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. Or even downstairs, like if they buy the fancy coffee drink, well, you can just drink water, right? You could, if you need the caffeine jolt, you can drink water and, you know, get those Vivid pills and kind of nibble on them throughout the day, right? Same effect, just as safe as coffee. You get the caffeine, but people like the taste of the coffee. And that's like $4 a day adds up, right? So now he gives another case where he says, so the case of Bob's Bugatti says, look, this at least shows people with significant resources, they're bad people if they don't use their money to help people who will die without their help. But he says, you might think, well, I don't have a Bugatti. I'm not a rich SOB. I'm barely getting by. Well, then he comes to the case of Dora. So Dora is living in a poor Latin American country. She's always wanted a color television set. And she finally has an opportunity to get one. And the way she does this is she hooks up this street urchin, this homeless kid, with a group an adoption agency. After the adoption, she puts two and two together and realizes that this is like a organ donation ring, and that they're going to like steal the kid's organs to save, you know, people in first world countries. So she goes back and tries to, you know, find the kid, and doesn't do any good. And so she feels guilty about it. So So the question about Dora is, you know, if she, did she do something wrong? If she knew that this kid was going to be killed and his organs taken, has she done something wrong? You think, well, yeah, of course she did. Now, in the movie, she doesn't really know, but, you know, she kind of thinks that maybe something funny's going on, but she really wants that TV. And so then she realizes what she's done afterwards. But you think that if she knew about it, she'd, it would be clear that she did something wrong. But then you think about, you know, maybe you don't have $200,000, maybe you got $300. Maybe over the period of a year, you have $300 sitting around that you could have used on something else. That you spent on frivolous pleasures that you could use to save third world children. And then Singer makes the point, after you, if you're watching that movie, you know, and you're in the art house theater, like if you're coming out of the Bijou, right, and you just plunk down your money, and maybe you're going out to eat afterwards, and you bought some overpriced popcorn in there, maybe you've blown 20 or 30 bucks between you and your friend or your date, and that's money you could have used to save third world children, but you're using it on frivolous entertainment. So, thoughts on Singer? What do you think? Yeah.
His examples are a little bit extreme to say. Much easiest example would be, okay, you see on TV, on the news, there's a lady who's dying from bone marrow cancer and she needs 50 grand to save her. You don't have 50 grand. It's across the board.
Yeah.
You don't have 50 grand, but you can pull out the second mortgage on your house and always save this lady one. But you don't. Does that make you a bad person? No. Pretty much nobody will pull out the second mortgage to save some lady on the girls with the world. But I mean, I think the utilitarian would is how you define. It's like, is it the entire world or your specific sphere of influence? So for the most people, it would be the sphere of influence, not the entire planet, as you know, on the thing. So I think Singer's definition is under whack.
Well, is it? But isn't it just because it that's one person? It's $50,000. With $50,000, you could probably save, you know, maybe 500 children or something like that, right, out of poverty. You could probably give them enough food, shelter, and clothing, clean water, and give them a high school education with that much money.
That is true. So wouldn't it be better to let this little kid get plowed by a train and then sell the Bugatti and save 200 kids?
Yeah, but
it's an
example of
opposite. Well, you're mixing the analogy with the sort of thing it's meant to represent.
I know.
So, the idea maybe if I mean it's a good question. Like people that go around in, you know, Mercedes, it's like if you're driving around in Mercedes, you could sell that and buy a Toyota, right? I ride a 1994 Toyota. It gets me from point A to point B. It's got like an AM/FM radio on it. It plays CDs. It's reliable. It's not too bad on the gas mileage. It will hold four people. You know what? I see lots of other cars on the road, and they're, you know, these new brand new cars. I see people driving these monster SUVs with like one person in them. I'm wondering, like, how often do they take that vehicle off road? How often? And I think about how much money people spend on cars. I even know college students that buy brand new cars, and they have enough money to afford $250, $300 a month, more with their car payment and their insurance. But they don't have enough to save starving children. Why? Because they don't care. And Singer says you should care, and you should stop spending money yourself and think about somebody else for a change. Yeah. Overpopulation? Well, actually, I mean, overpopulation is a regional problem. It's a problem in certain countries which have bad economies. So what happens when an economy industrializes, when it advances, the birth rate plummets. And that's why almost all of Europe has a negative population growth, even with immigration. Immigration makes it look like the population's steady or growing some, but if you look at the indigenous population, it's dropping. And then when immigrants from other poor countries move in to industrialized nations, their birth rate drops within a generation or two. So with the industrialization of China and India, where the two big, you know, places where there's lots of people, you'll get a drop. Although, I mean, even in China and India, those are massive countries. particularly China, is just a huge country. There's lots of space there. You could take all the people in the world and move them to the state of Texas and give them a suburban level living space and fit everybody there. It's just that there's certain people's places where people want to live, right? People like to live on the coast. If you look at a map of the world, you can see like all the lights, they're all dotted along the coast of every country. You know, people like mild weather, and people like, some people are, people go to the cities where the jobs are available and so on. Yeah.
What would Peter Singer say to someone that said, okay, well, you got this guy who lives a bourgeois lifestyle, makes $10 million a year. He's paying $5 million a year in taxes, so he's paying $1 or $2 he makes the government. So he's not getting $5 million in services from the government.
Right.
So the difference in that, he would consider his donation to society.
Yeah. It's like Singer would say that, and Singer actually agrees with the coercive taking from government, but he thinks, his argument is basically that government's not doing its job, and so it's up to you to voluntarily give to make up the difference, is what he would say. The UN does a crappy job of trying to solve world poverty, and really individuals need to pick up the slack, would be his argument. And that just because somebody else could give more doesn't mean you shouldn't be giving more too.
I think a lot of people would be all for that. Let everybody pay this, you know, the same amount of money and services they get, and maybe can donate their money, you know, accordingly to what charities they desire.
And that might be a long-term solution, like that sort of governmental, you know, coordination or something. But what Singer says is that in the meantime, people are dying. So you can't say, well, let's try to get the government to come up with a new program to solve the third world poverty. Well, I mean, governments have been trying to do this stuff for decades, and things haven't gotten much better. They've gotten a little better. So you wait in the back, and then you.
I think it's not just rich people that do that. I saw an interview, it's been 20 years ago, I guess, where they were interviewing poverty areas in the United States, and they interviewed this one lady, and they said, well, how poor are you exactly? She says, well, we're so poor that my baby has to sleep in the box the color TV came in. And I just thought that was just funnier than hell. I mean, it's all about priorities, you know?
Right, yeah.
Her priority was the color TV, not the crib for her baby.
Yeah.
Or food or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so
you look at people with microwave ovens and air conditioning and things, and we're like, well, that's just probably part of being a human. You know, it's, you know, and you know, these third world countries, it's not like people have indoor plumbing and the water they drink is so polluted that people get sick from drinking it. And things that we take for granted here are things that they don't have.
When I was in the military, we had a saying, and it was, which country are we going to send troops to? And it was the country we sent foreign aid to last year. And it was pretty much true, because the corruption was so pervasive. And we went into Somalia, and all the food that we gave them last year, and all, we stacked up in a warehouse being sold by these cartels. So, you know, just throwing money at it doesn't solve it when you have corruption and everything. So it's not just the money issue, it's the fighting for survival and corruption.
Right, and funneling things through government seems like not to be a good idea, just because the government tends to take stuff. And so you look at actually the private charities like Save the Children and the World Vision and some of these other groups actually do a pretty darn good job of getting food directly to people, because they fly it over in their own airplanes, they land at the airport, they might have to bribe a couple of petty officials, but then they go out there with the sacks of grain, and the Peace Corps is another good example where people actually go out there physically and they build a water system from scratch. They dig a well, they build an aqueduct, and they're not just giving money to some warlord or some government bureaucrat saying, here's a bunch of money from the IMF, now go and help your people with it, and usually gets squirreled away in Swiss bank accounts. Let's see, did you still have a point you want to make?
I'm wondering, like, if we did solve, like, poverty, what would the cost of, like,
what the outcome? I, the people wouldn't be starving and suffering. I mean, it's, that for, from a utilitarian's point of view, that would make the world a better place and add value. And you know, you would also have more educated people, and I think more people discovering, making scientific and discoveries, more people providing commercial products and services that, that can be traded on the open market. I mean, there are a lot of benefits. I mean, human capital is a major resource. Blake?
Well, okay, so Seeger's not only asking you to give up basically all of your pleasure from your disposable income to give to people you've never met who are in suffering. Also, you're also now morally mandated to pick the right charity because God knows 9 out of 10 of them, you know, you get waylaid or there's corruption or something and it doesn't actually go to them. And so he's asking you to do those things, and then he's saying that, well, everyone who can should. So anyone who can give up their pleasure in America or in a developed nation now no longer has it. But what about the utility? What about the lost pleasure of all of those people? Is there a moral downside to that? I mean, all these people now who could have been happier are now miserable because they have nothing to do. They have no disposable income. You know, so I mean, it seems like it's something that affects more than just like you have it good, they have it bad. You know, fix their lives. It affects everybody. Everyone's a human being.
But they've done studies on people like living in poverty, and basically, if you can get enough to eat and feel comfortable and safe and secure, the amount of extra happiness you have kind of tapers off, because people that live in the middle class, although they have some extra luxuries and, you know, cool gadgets and air conditioning and all sorts of, you know, sort of pluses, there's also trying to pay the mortgage and trying to manage investments and a lot of sort of parts of living in the modern world, which also adds stress and unhappiness to people's lives as well. And a lot of people that live in urban areas, people in urban areas tend to be less happy and more depressed than people living closer to nature. So that's also another issue. Evan and then Alexi, is that?
Well, I just wanted to bring up Doctors Without Borders. They're another really good charity if you want to help. But my point is, well, you know, you have these frivolous things, but, you know, if everyone just started, you know, stop spending money on that and just gave to charities, well then look at how many jobs would be lost, you know? And then you'd have less revenue made by people, and then, you know, the suffering and the job market and unemployment would cause a lot of problems as well.
Yeah, so you would have some consequences, and maybe the economy would change. You'd have less consumer spending in America. But maybe there'd be more spending in other things. Like, the thing is long term, though. Once those people get into a higher standard of living, they're going to sort of buoy the world economy too. Yeah.
Two things. Well, first of all, like giving up the frivolous things, like technology, like your iPhone and stuff. Technology drives progress, and consumerism does drive progress. Without the frivolous spending, there'll be technological stagnation. Just surviving doesn't mean you get technologically advanced stuff. I mean, like, there's plenty of countries where people just surviving, they're not exactly invented anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, the biggest progress drawn from either militaristic cultures, where army drives the progress, or from people spending money in the United States. I mean, like, iPhone generated like 3 different, you know, things, you know, technology.
Uh-huh.
That goes, you know, you going by him, that would be stagnation, you know, it's just inevitable. And second one is the best charity, the most effective one is the Peace Corps. Everybody knows that, everybody heard of them, and they actually do stuff themselves, they're not just sending stuff overseas to the wars. Who runs the United States government? The Peace Corps is actually an arm of the United States government, mm-hmm. So it's a government-run program. 10 times better than any volunteer organization we should run by private companies.
I'm not sure that's true. Well, it's not run by companies. I mean, it's run, you have non-profit organizations. Now, how about the following argument? Coca-Cola and McDonald's have done more to lift people out of poverty, and maybe Microsoft, than anything the Peace Corps has done, because world trade and call centers. So if you look at India and China, right? What you have people who are living subsistence living out there in the sticks. They've all moved into the urban areas to to get jobs at call centers or making iPhones, right? That's where all the parts of the iPhone are made is in China. And so really American consumerism is and world trade together are lifting people in the third and second world and out of poverty into the first world. And you're getting a large number of Indian and Chinese engineers and people that are moving into the middle class in those countries. And it's just sort of a process that, but it's all driven by American capitalism. Yeah.
Can you say, Barry Schwartz actually wrote an article called Tyranny of Choice that does a really good job of the point that you were making earlier about, I mean, he's basically saying the more choices we have, like statistically, the less happy we are. Mm-hmm. It was like mostly just in, you know, America, I think, where he did a study, but just like people that were surveyed, you know, across the country, it's like the more choices they had, the unhappier they were, the more miserable they were with everything because it was too much. Whereas people who didn't have as much choice were much more content and happy in their lives. And I think, I don't know, I think it makes sense. I mean, I think taking away, like, you know, for those things, I mean, how many of us, like, go and change our cell phones just because anyone comes out and it's like, oh, I'm way more badass than the one I have.
Right.
You know, there's nothing wrong with our phone. We just want a different one. So we go drop another $150, $200 on another phone just because it looks better or it does something cooler or whatever. So I think, like, taking away, even if it's only a portion, like, even if it's only half of our, you know, disposable income, I mean, we're a selfish nation, period. I don't know how you can get around that. And then another thing, too, like, with the whole, like, you know,
a little bit louder, I feel like, sorry, could you project more?
Taking away, like, from the happiness of, like, what you were saying, like, if you get rid of everybody's disposable income because they're donating it, that everybody in America is going to be all sad and blue. And I don't know, I look at it kind of like a scale, because it's overall happiness, overall utility across the world, not just your nation or your neighborhood or your house. You know, so it's like if you're helping all these other people, you're making them happier, sure, you're sacrificing a little bit, but you can't say that just because you can't go buy the new iPhone that just came out yesterday or go buy a new MacBook, that suddenly now you're miserable and life sucks. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, is you know, kind of off of her point and the other guy's point about, you know, free trade, stimulating growth and, you know, promoting new technologies, is like, what would happen to things like the video game industry? I mean, that's nothing but, you know, being frivolous. Microsoft would lose billions, Sony would lose billions, Nintendo would probably go out of business. You know, what would happen to the situation of things here, like for the movie industry? You know, if all of a sudden everybody stopped going out to the movies, well, then Hollywood would pretty much go bankrupt. Then if everybody decides they're not going to go out to eat at Applebee's anymore because that's frivolous, then that means that all of the restaurants are going to go out of business. So, I mean, all these different industries where people are having not only their jobs, but their livelihoods and everything tied to it would basically go out of business. And, yeah, we'd be sending all this money overseas, but half of our economy would basically collapse.
Well, people find different things to do with their time. I mean, their economic resources shift, but they don't sort of disappear. So they would just shift into to things which might be, you might argue, more humanitarian or more productive. And actually, if you look at the amount of money it would take just to give a subsistence living to people living in the third world, you're not actually talking about that much, that large amount of money compared to the amount of consumer spending. Anyway, I'll have a topic for this up in the forums. I think what I'm going to do is I want to do the small group stuff today. I'm going to the test will still be available, but I'm going to do the review the first say 25 minutes or half hour of class on Monday, and I'll give you an extra like half a week to take it. So you won't have less time if you take the test after Monday, but I'm going to do the review then. But I wanted to do this small group work on some of these scenarios here. Let me look here. Let's see how many people I got. Can I get a quick head count of the room here? Yeah.
Okay, let's start out with the group in the front here. So you guys have the organ donor transplant case. So you're trying to decide whether to try to kill an innocent college student with appendicitis or what have you to save five very important people. So what did you decide? What would a utilitarian say?
What do you think a utilitarian would say?
Okay.
And speak loudly, please, so everyone can hear you and so it's picked up on the recording.
All right. Well, one of the first things that we came to was whether or not it really truly would be the utilitarian choice to sacrifice the one person for the five. Because if that became a common practice, that would make it to where people would lose their faith in the health system, and they would develop issues with healthcare. I mean, if you thought that you could potentially die anytime you went into a doctor's office just because you had a cold, a cough, or something that could be fixed, then it's going to change how you view the world. And one of the things that Maslow's hierarchy of needs states that you have to have base needs met before you can reach self-actualization. And, a lot of ethical theorists believe that self-actualization is the pinnacle of achieving happiness. So if you can't meet food, shelter, and safety as your primary base needs, then there's no way you can continue on to actualization. So while in the long term you might create five more lives from that one life, the concept behind it that you're not safe at a doctor's office will make it to where it impedes your natural ability to be happy, because you can't proceed to self-actualization until you've been able to achieve safety.
Okay, next group, the fat man, Big Al. What do you have to say about him? So what's your take?
The utilitarians would blow him up. But if he went with the commander and designed the minister, they would all perish except for the guy stuck in the hole.
Okay, yeah.
They would be willing to kill him. I think that there's a different choice too, because there's five of them in the cave. Why don't they all just yank on him until they yank him back? Get out the hole and then stick him back in.
Okay, that's like a practical solution. Yeah. This is meant to hit on your moral intuition. So the idea there's no way to get him out except for by blowing him up. So although you don't intend to kill him, you do something which you know will have the negative side effect, that by blowing him out of the way and blowing his body to smithereens, it will have the foreseen but unintended consequence that he dies.
Yeah.
Let's see, way in the back here, what did you guys have? What did I give you?
We decided that...
What's your scenario?
Our scenario was the corrupt general and the supporters and executioner.
Okay, the general and the executioner, the execution choice. And loudly, please. So what did you decide?
We decided that we would shoot the one person to save the nine, since the other people would, or that one person would die anyways.
Uh-huh.
So
for the greater good. And
right.
We also thought that the utilitarian probably shoot the one prisoner to save the other nine. It's either save one and kill nine, or kill ten and save the one.
Right. So you agreed with the utilitarian there. Okay. You guys had the torturing the terrorist. What did you decide? So you tortured terrorists to avoid a nuclear bomb going off in a major city.
Well, our group was actually undecided as to what we would do, but utilitarianism would sort of dictate that the needs of the 10 million would sort of outweigh the needs of the one in terms of greater good. Although he brought up a point just a second ago that if perhaps, say, it was like, I'd say like Detroit, then greater good maybe just let it happen.
Okay. Oh, what did you guys have?
We actually chose the corrupt execution one.
Oh, okay.
Also, but we had the idea that what if it was a child that you had to kill to save nine adults? Or what if it was like a child, like a different, he wasn't part of the 10, like it was let 10 adults die and save the child's life, or shoot the child and save 10 adults, and we actually like, couldn't really think. I think we all pretty much agreed we'd kill one person to save nine if they were all like the same. But what if one of them was like, like 10 years old, and what would you do? Like, it totally changed the whole thing. Like, what if it's like, before there's three children and seven adults? Like, once you change it up, like, the dynamics a little bit, you realize you're weighted much more heavily towards one thing or another, because you value people differently.
Yeah, and as you tell Turing, you would like try to find the least valuable person. So look for some person with like maybe a handicap or maybe an old person.
Yeah, we would say like, oh, we shoot the criminal, or we would try and shoot one of the guards too while we shot one person. It's never black and white.
Well, then you die too. Well, for the utilitarian though, it is black and white because your circumstances are you either kill one or all ten are going to die. And your if the chances of shooting in general are pretty slim and you're going to get shot yourself, that's going to be negative utility if you die, assuming that you're doing good in the world too. So
you could also look at those like, hey, don't shoot the kids unless the other nine adults, die. They lived most of their life,
right?
Childhood there.
But I have to think in terms of right, though. You got to think in terms if a child has more potential, then that might be something. But a fully, it also depends on whether the adult is like showing themselves that like they've developed valuable skills. Like if you know one of the guys is a doctor, you don't want to shoot the doctor. Well, you can kind of look at people. Like if you see some guy with in his face and he kind of looks like he's kind of staggering, looks like he's drunk, shoot that guy. Some guy with a cane, you know. You look for the people that. You can tell a little bit, right? Anyway, you guys got the last scenario. What was yours?
Bioweapons job.
And speak loudly, please.
It seems like utilitarian would take the job and try to slow down the production, obviously, because they know the colleague would pursue gusto and make probably way better weapons. However, as far as like our own opinion, like what we do, we're kind of indifferent because I guess it kind of matters like how passionate you are about like the production of bioweapons like not being made. You might
suppose bioweapons are really, really bad.
Right. Then you might, you want to take the job and put yourself kind of take the risk of doing that on your own. However, at the same time, trying to expose this bioweapon lab also could ruin yourself and your career like that by, trying to take it down. So kind of one of those things that's it's really about how individually you.
But if bioweapons are really, really bad, and the best way to keep bioweapons from being developed is by taking the job, it seems like you'd be selfish not to take the job.
Right, right. But I'm saying also at the same time, like, I think maybe some people wouldn't care as much, people would be like, well, they're going to make bioweapons anyway.
But preference doesn't matter. All right. That's all we have time for. See you guys on Monday.